Welcome back once again for episode 292, Parish of the Patriots. Grandpa Dan with you once again this week. I'm glad to have you here. I'm glad you take the time to tune in or download later, whatever the case may be. I appreciate you coming back time and time again. It's my purpose in life, getting to have these discussions with all of you. Of course, I do assume the vast majority of you return members of the congregation. If you are new, I'm glad you're checking us out. I do ask that you'll stay for the whole thing. We do have a Christian-specific segment, a sermon, if you would. That's roughly the halfway point of the show, very roughly. Sometimes it's way earlier, sometimes a little later, but it's roughly the halfway point of the show. I encourage you to stick around and listen to it. One of the things I do have found entertaining at times is when I have heard from people who aren't necessarily Christian believers, and they'll write in and say, you know, or they'll email me, whatever the case may be, and they'll say, you know, I'm not a believer in that stuff, but I do find your takes on it extremely refreshing, very interesting, and they actually get something out of it, and that's good. That segment is aimed towards people who are already Christian believers. It's not really aimed towards non-believers trying to convince them of something. So that's why I put it separately. And that way, you know, if you're just absolutely going to spurg out about it and you don't want to hear it, then you don't have to. And you can enjoy the first part of the show as much as that were. If you do get something out of the show, you find something meaningful for it, don't be shy. I pay those tithes. It's easy. We got snail mail and... Oh, yeah, no, that's it. We've got snail mail. We've rocket old school because I'm kind of old. And that address is here on the description page for the Parish of the Patriots. It is very much appreciated. And with that having been said, listener, supporter, mailbag, GPD, keep up the great work. Any more news about Sven? That's from Mr. T. Thank you, Mr. T. I've talked to him twice since he's been moved to a different facility. And in a lot of ways, it's ironic because in a lot of ways, the restrictions on him right now have been more severe than when he was in prison. The prison email service that I was recommending people use at the time and whatnot, I mean, pretty reliable. And you could check the little box. It was cheap. It's cheaper than sending snail mail. And he used this email service, and it was really regular. And, you know, he gets moved out. He's on parole, what amounts what we in America would call parole. In Britain, they call it license. I don't know if it's a license for what, but he's on license. And he's essentially, I don't know, they have different names for it over there. Gay, British-sounding names. Not American names, but America, we would say a halfway house. But they have all these restrictions, and the way it's supposed to work is while he's in the halfway house, he works his way, you know, with his good behavior, which we all know he'll have. And you know, the restrictions are lifted. And my understanding is his behavior is, as you can all imagine, one of you knows Sven's character, you know, his behavior is so exemplary that the people that are overseeing him are already like, you know, they're like, well, this guy doesn't need all these restrictions. He's, you know, if he knows what the rules are and you tell him you can do this, you can't do that, you know, then he will do that. So anyway, no, he's doing good. And they have already lifted some of these. I have email access to him. I don't know how often he gets to check his email because he's not allowed internet access, but every so often he is allowed. So we do have that way, and once in a while I do get to speak with him. So it's a looking up, and he's doing well. He's adjusting. So, this is just the next step in him being able to move forward. We're going to get there. We're going to get there. Now, I don't share the email address with y'all because it is heavily monitored, and, you know, it's one of those things, the wrong thing worded a certain way, you know, they're going to take it out on him, not somebody. I can't share the information with y'all is the short of it. It's not because I'm stingy and I have his mailing address. They don't want that made public, you know, the authorities. So we're not making it public. Again, it's nothing against y'all. He really has expressed multiple times his appreciation for all of you stayed in contact while he was in prison. This is just a different phase, and we're not allowed to share that information. So we're not sharing that information. You know, there are certain people, like part of the restrictions, he's not allowed, you know, to have any contact with. Yours truly is not on such a list because I am of such high moral character as well. So, it's looking up. We just happened to slog through this. And at some point in time, you know, these restrictions will get lifted and he'll have, he'll have more freedom. So, yeah, he's doing well. Thank you, Mr. T. And I'll probably, I'm always glad to share information. I said through this whole thing, this has been years going on, you know, some time goes by. You know, others may forget. I ain't going to forget. Dr. Johnson ain't going to forget. And we're going to keep on keeping on. I do not know what the future holds as far as Sven's relationship with Radio Albion. This is always his thing. I'm just house sitting. I don't know eventually what he will or will not be able to do. I don't know if he'll ever be able to return to podcasting or not. I hope so. I mean, just even like the history programs he would narrate, the books and stuff, was very good content. So I'm hoping at some point he can return at least in some manner or another to podcasting. You know, I'm hoping at the very least, maybe at some point he can return to, you know, doing the show post, you know, at least just behind the scenes. You know, I don't even mind. I'll do the 3 shows a week versus my 1.5 shows a week like I used to do. I'll even do that if eventually we can get to the point where he can go back to managing and updating the content. You can go back to getting a lot more content like we used to get. You know, Dr. Johnson and I both, we do our best, but we're also very cognizant of the fact that, you know, you're getting content from 2 people versus multiple different sources and a live stream and all of those things that you used to get. So again, I say, on behalf of all of us, we really appreciate y'all sticking around. I know that the content level isn't what it once was, just because, again, Dr. Johnson and myself, we're doing the best we can, but still just, you're listening to content from 2 people. So thank you again, all of you, for sticking with us. And again, we'll get to the point. You know, hopefully we'll get to the point where he can at least go back to behind the scenes running things, you know, posting up content and whatnot and shows, and y'all can get more of a variety. Somebody wrote me here sometime back and they were like, you know, it's kind of, Radio Albion has kind of become such an American centric thing because, again, it's just Dr. J and myself, you know, and very much so. And hopefully maybe you can get back to getting some Britain, you know, some British content, some European perspectives, some other people. Some other shows. Anyway, what else we got here? I'm going to say Chris. Chris got more of a specific name. And I said last week, Charles, because yours was the one that I inadvertently shredded last week and had to do off of memory. I did not shred your note this week, Chris. So thank you very much. GBD, please use this tithe towards your ministry as Jesus Christ and you see best fit. And then, you know, I always edit for to keep things short. But Grizz went on to lament how Iran at that time had not launched any missiles or struck Israel. Now, I say it this way because since then, obviously, since the letter was written, that has occurred. And Chris had a take at the time, you know, like basically like Iran is controlled opposite. There is controlled. There is zogish, as perhaps the West is. And that's not my take at all. And I thought we'd get into that a little bit. And then we'll get into what I really kind of already had in mind to talk about. Things get complicated. War, how do I want to put this? War is not good for anybody. It's very clear that a lot of these, you know, these people, these nations, I mean, they don't want war, regardless of, you know, even if you win. It's kind of like I had a discussion here a while back about getting into a fight and what it's really like. You know, when you have all these government people, you know, agitating for war and they've never even been in a fist fight. Anybody who's been in a fist fight knows that even if you quote unquote win, you're the other, you're not going to come out of it like unscathed. It just virtually never happens. You know, I mean, unless I guess in those cases where certain people run up behind you and hit you from behind and knock you out, you know, they do that because in a regular fight, you're going to get some licks in. Win, lose, in between, you're going to get some licks in. And it's never fun. So it is with nations, you know. Even if a nation can, quote-unquote, win, they're going to lose something. The other side is going to get some licks in. And I think it's important not to, how do I want to put this? Not to attach, not to give, not to have a perspective that these people are like all-powerful. That's what they want you to think. I look at them, and they do. They have a lot of power, a lot of influence, but they're not omnipotent. And honestly, at the end of the day, my take is they're not really very smart. They're kind of clever, but they're not what I would classify as exceedingly smart. For instance, the way Hezbollah has behaved in this whole thing. You know, they've launched rockets into Israel, but it's been a very... I would classify it as kind of a restrained response. They respond, but they're not obviously launching everything they want to launch, or they could launch, I should say. Same with the Iranians. You know, it's like, why don't they just unleash? Well, they just unleash and let the Israelis have it. You know, if you're going to fight anyway. Now, I see a little bit of a move towards that. But like looking at Hezbollah, and you have this thing with the walkie-talkies and the pagers and turning all of these people, turning all of these people into unknowing suicide bombers by setting these devices off and all of this. And yet Hezbollah had such a very, I mean, it was a very restrained response. And it occurred to me, because again, time, you know, things have shifted a little bit. And Israel has gone in. They've pushed in ground forces. Now, when they first started moving their forces, when Israel first started moving their forces in, one of the articles I read on it noted that the, not Hezbollah, but the Lebanese army withdrew. They pulled back 5 miles. Of course, this was kind of portrayed in the media as, you know, they didn't want anything to do with the very powerful IDF. Who hasn't defeated Hamas yet in the Gaza Strip? They have these people corralled. They're literally like shooting fish in a barrel, and they still haven't managed to defeat Hamas. Now, the media portrayed this as, see, the Lebanese army pulling back. They're going to let Israel come in here and do what they want. And my first impression of that when I read that was that would be exactly what you would do if you were trying to draw them in. And when you take it as a whole, the way Hezbollah has really shown a lot of restraint in the face of Israeli provocations over and over again, to where people are just like, man, I thought Hezbollah was supposed to be tough and they're not doing nothing. It occurred to me that now what Israel is doing is what they wanted, is what Hezbollah wanted. I don't think Hezbollah ever wanted to get into a exchanging missiles and for bombs kind of fight, because that's where they're weakest. No matter how many missiles they have, they don't have an air force. If it's just an air capability fight, they're going to lose that because that's where they're weaker. You know, one of those fundamentals of fighting wars, you always want to make sure you're fighting where you're strongest and your enemy is weakest. Getting into an exchange of missiles and air power, that's where Hezbollah is going to be weaker. Iran, yes, they have Iranian support and Iran has missiles. You can only do so much with missiles. The U.S. has found that out, by the way. They've started bombing the Houthis again, even though the last time they did it did not work. U.S. and the U.K., of course, have started bombing the Houthis again on behalf of Israel, because it looks bad if Israel's just running around bombing everybody all the time. So somebody else has to step in. I thought it was funny because it's like, well, that didn't work last time. They did that last time and it didn't work. There's limits here. You can only do so much. Now, the Israelis have gone in on the ground. They've sent ground forces in. And it occurs to me that I think that's what Hezbollah has been waiting for, because that's where they're strongest. Just the other day, I already read an article. I mean, this just started. And Israel has already taken heavy casualties. they sent one of their elite units and got ambushed. One of their elite units went in, got ambushed, and they took heavy casualties. See, the ground war is what Hezbollah has been waiting for. That's their bread and butter. They were never going to come out if they turned it into an exchanging missiles and air power war, because they don't have that. Again, Iran has some missiles, but they're not going to, their support is limited in the sense that they're not going to go fly their air force over there and get into dogfights. That's silly. Hezbollah has been waiting for the ground operation. When I read that the regular Lebanese army pulled back, I thought, you know, that's exactly what you would do if you wanted to encourage them people. Come on in. Put the welcome sign out. Come on in. Sort of like if, you know, somebody was breaking in your front door and you don't say anything. You're just sitting on the other side in your easy chair with your 12-gauge shotgun and you're just being quiet. Just letting them bang on that door. Waiting for them to step through. That's really how it has occurred to me. You know, yeah, Iran could take more provocative actions. They don't, because war is not ultimately in their best interest either. It's not really something they want. All these provocations have been coming from Israel. All these other countries, yeah, they obviously don't want a war. If it comes down to that, they will ultimately fight, and they may be forced to do so. But I don't think their hesitancy should be read as they're actually all controlled by the Israelis. That's not my take at all. It's just these things are more complicated. You know, and again, you know, even if they make the determination we could actually ultimately win a war, yeah, half your country's still going to be bombed. We won. That makes us the winner. I think this is one of the foolish takes that Americans tend to have. I've always, one of my big criticisms, Americans have this war is a video game mentality. That's because America has not been bombed outside of, I guess, like 9/11 or something, or Pearl Harbor. But the American mainland has never suffered under war, even the world wars. There's always something somewhere else. Americans sit tight at home, going about their daily lives. Americans have never had the quote unquote benefit of having large bombs dropped on their cities. You know, there's complete decimation. As such, Americans tend to be stupid and foolish and agitate for war because they think it'll never happen here. It's a game to them. Now, with the way things are shaping up now, and Putin has made it clear that the ocean isn't going to protect you this time. You know, he's just like, you've got all these warnings. And these morons that are ostensibly in charge up there, they're just sitting around going, oh, well, he wouldn't really do that. Putin has come out and said, don't think that you're going out unscathed this time. If you keep escalating, you're going to get it. Going to get it. Now, people tend to say it's nukes or nothing. I don't even think it has to be nukes, personally. Imagine if Russia dropped, you know, a conventional hypersonic on top of the giant server farm that actually is the stock exchange, that building on Wall Street where the news people go in and the people are waving the cards around. That's just for TV. Oh, the stock trading's done on a big server farm in New Jersey. Imagine they dropped a hypersonic onto that and blah. Conventional. Doesn't have to be nuclear. You know, a lot of times the guy that talks the most shit, the first time he gets punched in the mouth, he doesn't know how to react. And I think it's kind of that way with the American people. They talk all this crap. These idiots running around. Well, they all, we all just go in there and start bombing the Iranians. Remember when that moron John McCain, before he went to hell, you know, he's a bomb, 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 bomb Iran. It's a game. People talk shit like that, ain't never been punched in the mouth. Like old Mike Tyson quote, you know, everybody got a plan till they get punched in the face. I think the American people, if just conventional bombs started blowing up shit in their cities, and it's like, hey, war's real. I think a lot of that enthusiasm for that fade really, really fast. Anyway, good stuff. Good stuff. Enjoying the good stuff for topics for discussion. Things are going to play out. It's clear that the Israelis are doing everything they can to drag the U.S. and its little puppet states into a conflict. Everyone else, the U.S. doesn't even want to, but they're controlled. The politicians are all owned. So whether they, what they want or think is a good idea is virtually irrelevant. The Israelis are the ones doing all of this provocations. All of this provocative action is coming from one side. The media keeps trying to pretend, you know, Iran finally launches some missiles back at Israel after Israel's is bombing everybody in the world. And then the media is sitting there talking about, oh my gosh, the Iranians are being so provocative. It just falls flat. It just falls flat. And now the Israelis have been drawn into a ground conflict in Lebanon. And that's where Hezbollah is strong. They're going to fight them where they have the advantage. They know the terrain. They train for this. They are hardened ground fighters. That's what they're at. So it just makes sense that Israel being drawn into the ground phase, that's what they've been waiting on. That's the part they've been waiting on. I thought we'd get into something else. What I really kind of wanted to talk about, and I think we still have time to get into it, is cycles. I was thinking about the season. We're in fall now. I always make a joke here in Texas. We spring and fall are some of our nicest seasons here, and they seem to last about 2 weeks. They last longer than that, but that's what it's like. It's like you're in the dog days of summer, and then fall gets here, and it seems like it lasts 2 weeks, and then it's cold. It's winter time. And people laugh. Live up in Yankee land where they get all that snow and ice and they hear what the temperature is in Texas. And like, it ain't even get cold there. Y'all don't even know what cold is. But we have a different kind of cold. I don't even know how to explain it. People that come here from Yankee land, they will even tell you the first winter here, they're like, this is a different kind of cold. The thermometer says it ain't that cold. Why does it feel so cold here? But I was thinking about the seasons, the world around us. I'm a firm believer. We understand our lives and our place in this world, a lot of it by the creation itself. I'll try not to be too preachy early, but it may get a little preachy. I don't apologize for it. Anyway, we learn about things by the world around us. We all know we got the seasons, spring, summer, fall, you know, autumn. We use autumn and winter, and our lives are the same way. You know, we have the seasons of our lives, spring. And I was thinking about it because the older you get, like I am, the more you think about it. And if you divide it by six segments, roughly segments of 20 years, because you got quarters, you got four seasons. And if you divide your life up into quarters of roughly 20 years a pop, that'd be springtime, 0 to 20. Just like the spring season, it's a season of growth. You know, you're born, you start at zero, you're born into this world. And everything is a learning experience. You're learning to talk, you're learning to walk, you're learning to interact with people. You eventually go to some government indoctrination school and try to keep your sanity. It's a constant time of growth from 0 to 20. It's a springtime. You hit puberty and you got these raging hormones because your body is saying it's time to start reproducing, just like in spring. And spring is a time of fertility. You know, the plants are coming up, the wildlife are running around. They've got babies and they're running around. Little fawns, the does are out there with their little fawns, and the cows are having calves. And you've got all, it's a time of birth. It's a time of growth, both in the season and in your own life from about 0 to 20. That is your springtime, a time of growth. You're fresh, you're growing, your body is maturing. You know, after a certain point, your body starts slowly dying, and it's way earlier than everybody thinks it is. But when you're growing, your body is making more new cells than it's dying off old cells. And then you, of course, hit that pivot, and the opposite becomes true. I'm way past the pivot, by the way. And then after that, you have adulthood, which is summertime. Again, in segments of 20 years, that would be from age 20 to 40. That's your summertime. The dog days of summer. That's just when you're working. You're just going through your life. Now you wind up, you know, and there's gray transition areas between. You're not setting a hard line here, but we're just trying to understand it. And you're working. You know, you settle in. This is what you're going to do. You find where your place in life, and that can change. But you go through, you settle into a routine. You just go through the dog days of summer and you're just going through what you're going through, you know, and you kind of, everything becomes kind of a routine. And it almost seems like this is just going to go on forever. It's just every day you get up, you go to work, you do the same thing. You go through the same motions each and every day. And it just seems like this is going to go on forever, which of course it is not. Because eventually, autumn rolls up on you. It really, you become really keenly aware of how short life is. You know, when you're young, when I was a kid, I was always looking forward to something. You know, I want to be old enough. I'm going to be in high school. I want to get my driver's license. I want to be able to drive. I want to be able to do this. I want to turn 18 and be an adult, and I can be out on my own, do whatever I want to. I want to be old enough to go to the liquor store and buy whatever booze I want to buy. I was always looking forward. I'm one of those people, I never really enjoyed my childhood, not because it's somebody else's fault, but because I spent my childhood always wanting to be the next thing older, you know? I wanted to do what the older guys were doing. As such, I kind of missed out on just enjoying where I was in life. There's a lesson to be held in that as well. Summer passes, and you wind up in autumn. And in that, be from roughly 40, age 40 to age 60, you're in autumn. I'm in late autumn now. And winter is a closing in. Autumn is like a transitional time in the seasons. The leaves are changing. The dog days of summer are coming down, you know, winding down. And days of old, not so much now, but maybe soon again. Autumn is a time when you're taking inventory. You need to find out how much you've prepared for winter. Back in the day, and again, maybe in the future, winter is something you spend the other seasons, especially summer, getting prepared for. You're storing up food. You know, you're chopping firewood so that you're prepared for the cold so that you don't freeze to death. And in autumn, you start taking inventory. Did I do enough? Do I have enough to get me through the winter? In the autumn of our lives, which I speak from experience, I'm in late autumn, looking at winter coming on hard now. And the autumn of our lives is a time when we tend to start taking that inventory. We start looking, you spend a lot of time looking back on your life and thinking, am I prepared? Am I really ready? Because winter is coming on. And then, of course, winter happened. Winter comes on. It's age 60 to 80. And most people don't make it to 80, so we can make it there. It's age 60 to 80. Now you are in the winter of your life. You can't do the things. You know, in the summertime, a lot of times you do things you don't want to do. You know, just because that's a part of it. In the winter, you don't do things because you just can't. You become more and more physically unable to do so. You get tired. Maybe your mind starts slipping. You start forgetting. Wintertime, everything starts slowing down. Just as in the winter seasons, things slow down. You know, in times of old, you've got your firewood you chopped and hopefully your food you stored, and you're huddled up. You know, kind of like the bears hibernating. You're huddled up in the house because you can't go outside and do much because it's cold. There's snow and ice everywhere. You can't be out planting no crops in the wintertime. You just kind of, everything slows down because you can't do the things you normally used to do. Again, it's the same thing. You would huddle up in your house because you can't go out and farm. It's wintertime. It's too cold. The ground's frozen. What are you going to do? Now, one of the things I find interesting are people who are unable to recognize, and this is why I thought we'd talk about it. One thing I find interesting are people who are unable to recognize the seasons of their lives. It's a sad thing for a man to miss his season. You got to be prepared. In the Bible, we're told you be prepared in season, out of season. Understanding where you're at in your life. What season are you even in? And find it humorous. And I'm not even trying to baby boomer bash, but the baby boomers are such an interesting example of a generation who, by and large, obviously we're not talking about all of you, but by and large, as a generation, has been unable ever to accept what season they're in. And now they're old enough, you have these people who are in winter. They're in the winter time of their lives, and they're still running around trying to act as though they're in the spring. I just find it just interesting. It's not even a critique. I just find it fascinating to see a people who are in the winter season of their lives. I mean, they're observably in the winter season of their lives. I've known of baby boomers who there they are. They're in the winter. In other words, they're old. Everybody who sees them knows they're old. And yet, they'll be vain about their appearance. They're worried about their appearance as if they're still a teenager. How many baby boomers do you run into? And again, I'm not trying to bash. It's not that. I just find it fascinating. You'll have a baby boomer, and I've known several instances of this, and some guy, you know, you're old, you're in winter now, but you know, they will stand there and talk to you. I don't know, I've had this happen to me multiple times. One of these guys will stand there and talk to me about their girlfriend. They'll go on and on about their girlfriend. It's like, you have a girlfriend when you're in the spring of your life. You're in winter, man. You ain't got no girlfriend. You know? Well, I've been married 5 times, but I'm thinking about making it number 6 with my current girlfriend. That's somebody who can't accept what season they're in. They've missed their season. They've attempted to hold on to spring their whole lives. We've seen the different quote, 30, you know, back in the day, because I'm old enough to remember, they go around and say, oh, well, 30's the new 20. You know, when they were 20, they said, don't trust anybody over the age of 30. And then when they were 30, they were like, 30's the new 20. Then 40 was the new 20. Now 60 is the new 20. The ones that make it to 80 will probably be like, 80's the new 20. I'm still ready to go to Woodstock or whatever the hell. And it's just fascinating to me. Again, I'm not even trying to be critical. I just find it interesting that people cannot accept what season of their life. Because these seasons have a purpose. When you're young and it's springtime and your fertility is at its peak. The summertime when you mature and who you are. Of course, none of this stuff is actually going to matter unless you're also spiritually maturing. But I digress. Autumn is a time of reflection. I know, I'm in autumn now. I spent a lot of time reflecting. Things I should have done. Things I regret doing. Things I did right. How I've lived my life as a whole. I've lived, you know, spiritually speaking. Again, I'm not trying to preach early, but I don't care. I'm going to say it. You look back at how you've lived your life as far as your relationship with God. Because in the autumn, you become keenly aware that that matters more and more. Because you see, when you're in spring or summer, you can forget about death. Death can be in the back of your mind because you're just going along and that's way off. Winter is a long time away. When you get into fall and ultimately winter, death becomes very imminent. You're facing death now. Running around acting like it's still springtime isn't going to change the fact that death is way closer now than it's ever been in your life. In the autumn, you should be reflecting as a spiritual person, as a Christian person. You should be looking and it's like, what's the totality of how I've lived my life? Have I always tried, you know, as a general theme to get closer to God, to learn about Him, to do these things? You know, I'm not talking about how, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, how much sin you've committed. Everybody's, you know, that's called working through your shit. That's just part of the process. What's the overall thing? And then as you enter into winter, your goal should be to finish strong. That's my goal, finish strong. When I got my first cancer diagnosis, you know, and I didn't know, you know, they were throwing terms around that were very scary. And when I got the first diagnosis, I walked out and got in the vehicle to drive myself home. And I thought about, what does this mean? I'm going to be here next year, 6 months, 5 years from now. Drove it home. And the first thing I determined of myself is I'm going to finish this strong. I'm going to finish out strong. You know, I've lived my life trying to seek the Lord, trying to share with what we do here. I share whatever, you know, insights I think God has blessed me with y'all, so maybe it'll mean something to y'all. And I thought, I'm not going to dishonor that. I'm going to honor that by finishing out the way I've tried to live, to finish out strong. Now, two cancer surgeries later, and that's kind of in the rearview mirror. Everything's looking good, I'm glad to say. But when you realize I'm going into winter, I'm late autumn, getting ready to head into winter, and when you're talking about the last 20 years, I mean, that's nothing. I figure, realistically speaking, I probably have less than 20 years left on this world. And I tell people that, and they think I'm being like doom and gloom and depressing, and not at all. I'm just being realistic with myself. I want, you know, in other words, I still want to finish out strong. It's the same as when I came out from that first cancer diagnosis, and I didn't know what we're talking about here, 6 months, a year, what we mean. Nothing has really changed, because at the end of the day, 5 years, 10 years, you know, it goes by really fast. I still want to finish out strong. And perhaps that's the whole point of understanding the seasons. You should be at a point when you go into winter, instead of running around trying to act like you're still in springtime, you need to be cognizant of death. Be cognizant of it. And that way you can set your attention and your focus on finishing out strong, on pursuing, you know, a strong finish. Imagine you go through a marathon and you can see the finish line now. You know, you've been running and running and everything just looks the same, and you're following the little arrows people put down, and you're exhausted, your body's tired, you're aching, but you can finally see the finish line up there. That's not the point where you're just going to, I can't do this and quit. This is the point where you say, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. Now is the time to finish. Paul said, you know, I've run the race. I've fought the good fight. You know, things are winding down. Now is the time you just want to finish strong. And you can't do that if you don't even understand what season you're in, is the point, I suppose. Because at the end of the day, when you hit winter, there's no spring coming around for you in this world. You know, in this world, it's cyclical because that's how it is. I mean, there is a spring in this world, but not for you. You see, the spring comes about when you look and you see your grandchildren born. That's their spring. So you see the spring coming about for others. But for you, winter is it. You're never going to see another spring in this world. Your next spring will be in the kingdom of God. It's best to be as prepared as possible for that. Now, I got a little preachy there at the end, and it is what it is. Now we're going to officially get into that segment. That's right. You know what to do. Get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's official Christian-specific segment here at the Parish of the Patriots. Now, having been speaking previously on the seasons of life, kind of going to stay in that theme here. And I'm sure most of you, virtually all of you, are familiar with the meme or the illustration thing, you know, of hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men. And weak men create hard times. And it all goes around in a circle, in a cycle. And there is quite a bit of truth to that. Reflecting on that, we have the hard time. It kind of reflects also for spiritually. And I thought we'd get into that. One of the most, you know, if you were given a choice, you know, we know as believers that we're here for a particular reason. We're here to grow spiritually, to mature, to get ready for the next life. And yet, we all want good times. This is very, the state of the times is very much something on people's minds, because we are in a time of change, a time of transition. Things are getting worse, and nobody who is dealing with reality on any level whatsoever thinks that they're going to get better anytime soon. this can be distressing and worrying. We all want to live in good times. I'm of an age to where I've kind of lived through a lot better times in my younger part of my life, and here I am getting older, and we're entering into a really turbulent and transitional time. We all, by our instinct, we want to live in good times. We want things to be great. But I was thinking about that graph, the cycle about hard men and creating good times and so on and so forth. And I was thinking earlier this week about how that applies to our spiritual selves as well. And it's kind of the same. One of the most difficult times, if you set aside the things that don't matter, which is essentially at the end of the day, everything in this world, because it's all temporary, it's all going away. If you set aside the things of the world and strictly spiritually speaking, what exactly are hard times? It is written that wisdom is found in the house of mourning, and fools are in the house of feasting and laughter. That isn't to say that we're supposed to go around being doom and gloom, but what it does speak to is what cultivates spiritual wisdom. With that in mind, and thinking of that cycle that's been illustrated about hard times and good times, and I was thinking about these tumultuous times and what it means for us spiritually going into these times. And I was thinking about, in spiritually speaking, the quote-unquote good times, prosperous times, spiritually speaking, those are probably some of the most difficult to go through times. You see, it's kind of a mirror reflection of how it is for the physical. Physically speaking, carnally speaking, temporally speaking of this world, we all want to live in the good times. But yet, spiritually speaking, those good times are some of the hardest to spiritually overcome, because you do not want to think about the Lord. You look back at, say, the era, the heyday of the baby boomers, and you're looking at the 60s, say the 60s and 70s. And in many ways, these times were good. They were not without trouble. No times in this world are without any trouble. But all in all, they're considered pretty good times. But what did that equate to for the spiritual health, the spiritual state of the people of a nation? Did that lead to a spiritual revival? Did that lead to more and more people, coming to the Lord? Or did it lead to an abandonment of God? This is nothing new. When you read the Old Testament and the different cycles that the nation of Israel went through, the real nation of Israel, when you read about that, it was much the same. They had wind up with a wise king, and the people would turn their hearts back to the Lord, and things would get good. And then in the next generation or so, when things are good, they forget all about God, and they go whoring after idols, cheating each other, breaking God's laws left and right, and they forget about the Lord. And then when the hard times come back around, then they're all, why does the Lord not save us? Why does the Lord not deliver us? That's reflected how that is. Spiritually speaking, some of the toughest times to go through for us spiritually, or in times, are good in this world, because we have a tendency not to think about the Lord. We don't need to think about God. Heck, everything's good. Everything's going. When times are tough, it tends to force you to turn your hearts towards the Lord. A lot of times because there's nothing else. You've got nothing else to hope for, so you turn your heart toward the Lord. I was told a story long ago. This is a true story, by the way. And a very rich man, he asked a man who was a hired man. He says, do you believe in God? And the hired man responded and said, well, yes, I do. And the rich man responded and laughed in mockery. And he says, that's just something made up for poor people so that they can cope, so that they can get by in life with some sort of hope. He says, I don't need God. I've got my money. Now, this conversation happened many years ago. Since then, the rich man is long dead. What did his money buy him? What did his money purchase? But see, he had no need for God. He has his money. And that was his, and he said it straight out. Sadly, many people are of the same mind. They may not say it flat out as this man did. I don't need God. That's for poor people. I've got money. I buy what I want. What do I need God for? Now, again, he's long dead now, and now he realizes too late why he needed God. But when the times are good, when you're doing well, these are the hardest times to bear down and spiritually seek out the Lord. When you're suffering, when you're mourning, you're suffering a loss, or you can't find an answer, this is when you reach out and struggle because you can't come up with the answer. You try to find it with the Lord. So spiritually speaking, these good times are some of the hardest times to go through. Like I say, you look through a time like the 60s or 70s in this country when things, you know, economically we're okay, we're doing pretty well. And, you know, even amongst regular people, did that lead to spiritual growth or spiritual decline? And again, you read in the Old Testament about the cycles that the nation of Israel went through, and it was the same thing. You things got good and peaceful, the people turned away from God. People turning away from God caused societal decline, decay, and degradation. The societal decline, decay, and degradation, I can't talk this morning, degradation led to harder times. The harder times led to the people crying out to the Lord to deliver them. And if the Lord sent a prophet, he would explain to them what they needed to do. And if they followed through with that, the Lord would restore peace and security to their land. And then the cycle would start all over. You see, it's very akin to that cycle about hard men creating, you know, or hard times creating strong men and so on and so forth. And I guess the takeaway from this, before we move on to something else, as we are transitioning into troubling times, and again, that's undeniable, it can be troubling, but don't let your hearts be too troubled. It's also an opportunity to find more wisdom. As things get worse, this will be an opportunity for a lot of other people to perhaps turn towards the Lord, and is for yourself an opportunity to spiritually grow all the more, which is our ultimate goal. As things continue to degrade and get more hard, more difficult in the physical world, we find wisdom in the house of mourning and understanding as we go through various forms of suffering. It's just kind of, trying to make you feel a little better. I mean, nobody wants the hard times. It's a weird thing because it causes a disconnect. You know, if you ask anybody, you know, what kind of life do you hope your kids will have? Well, everybody to a man will answer, well, I hope they do better than me. You know, they make more money, have a nicer house, and you more financial security and a better life. But if you said, well, do you want them to be, you know, to spiritually grow? Well, yes, of course I do. I want them to spiritually grow. And yet we know spiritual growth comes from suffering. So we're kind of wishing for things that are in opposition to one another, aren't we? We're hoping our kids or grandkids, whatever the case may be, you know, we're hoping that they have a quote-unquote good, prosperous life. But we're also hoping they gain wisdom, knowledge, and understanding in the Lord. We don't want them to suffer, and we want them to know God really close. And those things oftentimes are in opposition to one another. If you're going to know and understand the Lord, you're going to go through suffering. You're going to go through these times when you're questioning and you're not sure what's going on, and there's a lot of uncertainty in the world around you. So something, again, it's just something to keep in mind as we see things going the way they are. I thought we had to talk about something else here as well. We got plenty of time. Let's look at Matthew chapter 17, and we're just doing verses 24 through 27. I just read this. Well, I'm recording this on Saturday. I read this yesterday. So I was going through my daily Bible reading. I was reading this particular chapter of Matthew. And this little incident, I find it informative and interesting. Sometimes these little things that get described, that so often I think people just read through them and it's like, oh, well, that happened. You know, and they don't stop and really think, you know, it's easy to go through this and don't stop and think about, what does that mean? And this is one of those times. How often do the Gospels get read in any church to varying MCC degree in the world today? And they probably read through this part and just kind of skim through it. And it's like, oh, wow, God did a miracle there. That was really cool. Let's go ahead and read this real quick because it ain't going to take long. And when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, doth not your master pay tribute? He saith, yes. And when he was come into the house, Jesus prevented him, saying, what thinkest thou, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or strangers? Peter saith unto him, of strangers. Jesus saith unto him, then are the children free. Notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, go thou to the sea and cast an hook, and take up the fish that first cometh up. And when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money. Take that and give unto them for me and thee. Now, like I said, probably most people, when they read through this, when they read what we just went over, the thing they take away from it is, wow, we had him go down there, cast out his fishing line. He pulled up a fish, and sure enough, he opened the fish's mouth, and there was a silver coin or gold coin or whatever. There was this piece of money, just like Jesus said. It was a miracle. It was a miracle. Jesus did another miracle. But see, I find interesting things when you really back up and look at what was said and what was done. And you think of this tribute as like a forced offering. You know, it's like you go to the MCC or whatever church and they pass the plate around. And you voluntarily put money in there. The tribute is a little less voluntary and a little more compulsory. Do you pay tribute? Do you or your master pay tribute? Now, Peter answers, yes. He doesn't want any trouble. He's oh, yeah. You know, and Jesus tells Peter, you know, who gets tribute exacted by a king, his own children or foreigners? And he says the children are free. In other words, what Jesus is saying here is we don't owe them nothing. They're demanding a tribute. Now, he tells him, well, go on down so we don't offend them. That's fine. But go down, catch this fish. There's money in his mouth. Pay him for me, the Son of God, and you, for both of us. There's your tribute money. I'm sure those exacting tribute walked away quite happy. They got their money. But think about what that means. They exacted tribute from the Son of God, and the tribute money, Jesus. When he tells Peter to go down and catch the fish and the money would be in the fish's mouth, this isn't about a miracle. And that's how everybody reads is they read it and say, oh, wow, it's a miracle. God put money in a fish's mouth. But I don't think that's the point. Jesus, when he tells Peter, we don't owe them anything, but so that we don't offend them, go down and do this thing with the fish. You see, Jesus never paid him any tribute. When he said, well, Peter, we don't owe him anything. Then he tells him, he didn't need to go through this whole exercise of go catch a fish and there'll be a coin in his mouth. He tells, they had a money purse where people would give them donations. They would, you know, well, they saw him doing miracles. They would pitch some money to him. He could have just gone to the money bag. And whatever money was in there that Judas hadn't stolen, they could just took a coin out of there and just paid him. That would have been a lot simpler and a lot more straightforward. There's a reason he didn't do that. See, Jesus didn't pay them shit. When Jesus was not going to contradict himself. He tells Peter, we don't owe him anything. The children are free. We don't have to pay these guys tribute. But they want their money. These guys collected tribute. Jesus didn't pay them anything. These guys collected tribute from God himself. Think about what that means. These guys demand their tribute, and then they get it. They were probably like skipping on the way home. Yeah, we showed them. We got the money. They collected tribute. They demanded tribute and collected a coin. Let's say a silver coin, just to keep things simple. I don't know what denomination of money it was. Let's say they collected a silver coin from God. You imagine in your foolishness exacting, first you demand tribute from the Son of God, and then you think you did good because you collected it from God himself, from the Father himself. You collected your silver coin you're so proud of from the Lord, and you think you did good. Man, we got the money. Let me tell you something. What those men collected that day from the Lord, that is just a terrifying thought. In their ignorance, in their worldliness, in their greed, what they collected, that silver coin, what they collected from the Lord that day was all they were ever going to get from God. That was it. They exacted tribute from the Lord. Imagine reaching the day when they reached the day of the Lord, when they came to an end so many years ago and came face to face with the Lord and facing the realization they've already received everything they were going to get. We want the kingdom of God. And the Lord essentially, you can imagine the Lord essentially being like, I've already paid you. You demanded tribute. You got it. Where's your silver coin now? They wound up exacting tribute from God. And as such, they received everything they were ever going to get right there in that moment. And they thought they did good. They skipped a little back to the house. We got a silver coin. We can go buy some drinks tonight and a good meal. We've written, you know, some people, their God is their stomach. That's what it means. They're all thrilled to death. They're going to take this coin they received tribute for and go buy a good meal. And they think they're winning. They've received it from God. They exacted a tax from the Lord himself. And that's all they were ever going to get. This is a terrifying thought. Now, as I say, we have no idea how much the money was worth. It was enough to be a reasonable tribute to cover for both Jesus and Peter. You know, whatever the amount of money. I mean, it's not like it was a huge amount of money, but it was enough that when Peter handed it to the guys demanding tribute, they were like, oh, okay, yeah, that'll cover two of y'all. You see, the amount of money, the denomination of money is really, when you look at it in the context of their collecting tribute to God, it doesn't matter how much it is, does it? It doesn't matter if this, put it in our modern American money. It doesn't matter if it wouldn't matter if it was a $100 bill or $10 million because it's all temporary. It's all going to be gone. It wouldn't matter. There is no amount of money that would be worth collecting from God so that when you reach the day of the Lord, you realize you've already received. $10 million would seem like a pittance and utter foolishness in the context of the eternal, in the context of the kingdom of God. It is written, what gaineth a man what profiteth a man if he gain the whole world but lose his soul? In other words, the entire world is trivial when you reach the day of the Lord and you've sold out. I often see these guys, you know who I'm talking about. You know how I feel about them. They stand up there, they got a TV show, you know, and these TV preachers in their nice suits and all their money. and they living it good. And they talking about how you need to give them more money because Jesus wants them to have a new private jet or whatever kind of ridiculous, money. And you see, they might receive it, you know. And maybe it's easy to feel a little bit, you know, you might look at that and say, well, that's not right. How are these guys doing so well? But you got to remember, that's all they're getting. that is all they're getting. They're collecting, how do I want to put it? There's enough written about the dangers of wealth, and this reflects to what we talked to earlier, because good times are some of the, you know, earthly good times are some of the most difficult times spiritual. That's why it's written over and over, you know, that it's so difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. It's not that God has something against a rich man. It's just a rich man will have a tendency not, you know, to quote unquote, not need God. Now, if it is so, generally speaking, and I think it is well proven that the better things are, you turn your heart away from the Lord. If it is so difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, how much more so for one who is rich because he's been shearing the sheep that belong to the Lord, that he's been making his wealth, deceiving people, tricking them, slick-talking them, conning them. People that might, you know, in all honesty, they're just trying to reach a closer understanding of God. And this guy, he cons them and he gets the money from them. Again, the amount of money is irrelevant because it's all insignificant when you reach the day of the Lord, because that's all you were ever going to get. To stand up there and collect money and have great wealth while you're parading around talking about Jesus, it's a very, very dangerous thing, because you could wind up being like the ones collecting tribute, and they're collecting tribute directly from the Lord. At the end of the day, that's all they were ever going to get. Anyway, I just find that interesting, because again, people read that and the only thing they take away from it is, wow, God provided a miracle. He had a coin turn up in a fish's mouth. And you miss the bigger context. Those guys, what that meant for the guys collecting the tribute. They collected it from God. Jesus didn't pay them nothing. They collected tribute directly from the Lord. From the Lord. Not from the donations that people were giving to Jesus and his apostles. Directly from the Lord. And when you think of it that way, you know, it's terrifying. It's a terrifying thing indeed. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this week's Christian specific discussion. I hope you enjoyed the whole show. Hope you got something out of it. I do appreciate you coming back, and I hope, like I say, hopefully you got something out of it. Hopefully you enjoyed it. And as always, I hope to see you back here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.